Okay, now the Passover, as everyone knows, is a night when the things are discussed at the Seder and ideas are discussed. As a matter of fact, just this morning we were studying the piece of Talmud that translates the word, says in the Torah, it says poor bread, but the word is written. The letters mean poor, but the pronunciation that we use has another meaning also. The not bread of affliction, but it means bread of answering, speaking. So the Talmud says that this bread, this matzah that we eat, is that we say many things over it. Okay, we say many things over this bread. It's an interesting concept. But an important one, which means to say that the bread is, I would say, it's intellectual bread. In other words, before we eat the matzah, we have long discussions, ideas, concepts, philosophy, commandments, Torah, halacha. We say a lot over that bread before we get to it. Why? Because the eating, and that actually, according to halacha, that actually qualifies the matzah. The reason is because the Torah gives us physical commandments, but the physical commandment is really there in order to engage the soul of man and the mind of man. So when God gave us the commandment of eating the matzah, it's not a ritual. It's not a mere symbolic action. That's not what it is. As a matter of fact, if God wanted to make the night of Passover symbolic, the proper way would be to do just like they did, which means, you know, to have the your belt tied and your staff ready and get dressed up as if you're going to leave Egypt. But that was not the way God did it. God saw fit. He took certain items that was there then, and he made them into eternal commandments, but he never asked us to do things that would duplicate, would look like a symbolic kind of going out of Egypt. No such thing. The reason is very simple. The reason is because when people get involved in symbolic actions, the emotions are engaged. God wants the person's mind to be engaged, and he wants them to study those things that have to do with the going out of Egypt. That's very important. But essentially, the action really is created, the mitzvah is created to evoke the soul of man, not to put him in a state as if he's going out of Egypt and just symbolically bring him back to a fantasy that he's trying to fantasize the going out of Egypt. That's not what the Torah's objective. That were God's objective. So then, of course, the best way to do it would be, just like it's written in Exodus, to dress and be ready and eat the Paschal lamb in every generation as if you're about to go out, just like they did. And that was, for them, it was a commandment. They had to eat it in haste. But for the generations, that was never a commandment. Only certain things that are in that chapter on how they were obligated to eat it are eternal. Other things are not. So how do you know which is which? That's where the oral law, the scholars, and no one maintains, no scholar ever maintained that that those the other things and the that were obligated on them. In other words, such as having their staff in their hands and being ready to leave, that was a part of the eternal commandment. That was just something that they had to do in Egypt because of their situation and because of their state. And for them, that involved a perfection at that time. But eternally, forever, there's no such law. However, the Paschal lamb did remain forever, and matzah did remain forever. And the reason is, as I said, the reason why God removed those things which would be most symbolic of leaving Egypt and left some of them is the ones that actually, of course, matzah was eaten in Egypt, but the reason why he left the ones that are less attached to the actual going out is very simple, because God does not, the whole Torah teaches man that the mind and the soul have to be engaged in man, not the fantasy part, not to fantasize, not to be involved in symbolic fantasy of going out of Egypt. That's not what the Torah wants. The Torah wants you to understand, to think, to gain the knowledge of the ideas of the redemption. And the matzah is that's why the Talmud says the matzah is called, it's intellectual bread. It's bread that we speak many ideas about before we engage in eating it. Because the eating is a commandment, and halacha is extremely important. We cannot deviate one eye performance that God commanded us to do. The action is important because the action engages us, forces us to be engaged, it pulls us in to the ideas of Torah. And that's the unique process of halacha. The unique process of halacha, only Torah has such a concept. Now, what I'd like to discuss tonight is what is the concept of miracles? Okay, what is the idea of miracles, and what is the importance of miracles? People are drawn to miracles, and primitive religions always try to pull man into miracles, miracle workers. We in the Torah don't have miracle workers. We never did. Most of the prophets, we don't find any miracles. The exception, of course, is Elijah and Elisha, his student, and that was only because at that time the Jews were so swayed away from Torah. It was necessary to have miracles like the miracle at Mount Carmel, because they were all steeped in idolatry. Elijah, that's why Elijah, by the way, if you look carefully into the prophets, you'll see Elijah is like a miniature of Moses. He went 40 days without food. A little differently, though. You got to look carefully there. A little differently. He went to Horeb. He functioned like Moses in a small way. Of course, the Torah says no one will ever be like Moses, in a different quality, different level. But Elijah was the greatest of the prophets, and he was similar. That's why in the prophets he's depicted as being similar to Moses, because he also, through miracles, he brought the people back to he was able to fight to combat the idolatry. And in order that Torah should remain with us, but essentially Torah really veers away from miracles. Miracles really don't really have any lasting effect on people. That's why the Torah insists on knowledge. But miracles do teach us something. They are not unimportant. They teach us something. Well, what miracles? You see, it's not the fantasy of miracles, the illusion of miracles. People are attracted to miracles because people are basically looking for sensationalism. And this is really this is primitive religions. Always have miracles, miracle healers, miracle workers, all these type of things. Our Torah, we have prophets that teach ideas, that teach knowledge, not prophets that perform miracles. Okay. As a matter of fact, the Messiah King, as Maimonides says, is not necessary for him to perform miracles. That's not what he will come to do. He'll come to do what Isaiah says, to teach people, to teach man, to enlighten mankind. So the question is, what do miracles teach? And why was it necessary to have miracles at all? After all, I mean, the Torah says that Mount Sinai is once and forever, never will happen again. God doesn't like to destroy the laws of nature, to compromise the laws of nature. The laws of nature are beautiful. All the prophets speak about the fact that the laws of nature express goodness and the wisdom of the Creator, and even momentarily to interfere with them is not really God's will. He had to do it. It was necessary, but it was only done because it was necessary for a moment at that time in order to establish man, but not on an ongoing basis. Now, but what does it teach man? What do miracles teach man? So Nachmanides very beautifully explains what the whole purpose of the miracles in Egypt were, and he says that the reason why miracles were necessary, the miracles in Egypt. The reason why they were necessary is because there were certainties, and there are certain theories that people hold. And it's very difficult for man to arrive at the truth just from his own intellect. And even if he would arrive at the truth from his own intellect, certain areas he can, other areas it's basically impossible for him to arrive at the truth. There's no way that he could logically know certain things. And even those things which he can know, there are only a few people that are able to think on that level. You see, thinking on a true Torah level demands two things. It demands a very great intellect, that's number one, but it also demands a certain type of emotional makeup. A person has to have the proper emotions, and also it demands a certain kind of perfection of the personality, which means the person is searching for truth and not trying to say things that fall in line with their own emotions. People are always trying to... The problem with those who misinterpret the Torah, they have preconceived notions, and what they try to do is look for some verse or something that seems, or they think, on the surface, is saying what they believe. And then they'll say, oh, that's right there in the Bible. You see? That is not the method of Torah. The method of Torah is for a person to simply be engaged in truth because they're searching for truth, not because they want to justify certain premises that they, certain illusions that they have. But my Nachmanides explains, he says, like this, what were these theories? There's several theories. Some people, of course, didn't believe in God at all. They just like today, people that are atheists, they just do not believe in God. They only believe in nature. And they say that the universe is the only real thing behind the universe. That is reality. And, of course, you know, there are many scientists today, many people today that still believe that. And then he says, some say, others said, that no, God exists, but God is the source of all knowledge, yes, true, but God doesn't have knowledge of particulars. You see, that happens to be a very big philosophical theory, that God can only know universals. He can't know particularly. He cannot know that a particular ant is moving on a particular leaf at a specific time. That God doesn't know, because God's above that. All he knows is universals. He created everything, and he created them with universal principles, because, you know, everything in the universe works according to laws, and he is the author of all those laws, but he doesn't know particulars. They're too unimportant for him, and they're not. He simply has no knowledge of them. That is a theory, by the way. One of the people in the Torah that held that theory, to a degree, was Balaam. Balaam said, that was one of the things that Balaam thought to himself. He said that, in spite of the fact that God warned him that he won't go, it was because when God said to him, who are these people that are with you? So Balaam said, you see that? He doesn't know every detail. I'm going to pursue this further, and I'll figure out when he doesn't know things, and then I'll be able to do... things against his will. So Balaam really was dabbling in that theory. It's a well-known philosophical theory that God doesn't know particulars, and that's one of the theories that miracles were brought into existence to disprove. A third theory is that God knows. He knows everything. He knows the general principles, of course, of the universe, and he also even knows the particulars of the universe. But the only thing is that God simply does not care. He's not involved in human life. Human life is not important enough for God to be involved in. And that theory is mentioned by the prophets. Ezekiel mentions it. God has left the land, okay? Which means that's the theory of those, and many philosophers maintain that way, and many great thinkers thought that way, too, that God knows, as a matter of fact, Albert Einstein was of that opinion, that he believed in God, and he thought that God is all-knowledgeable, but he says God doesn't really bother with man. Man is not important enough. You see, the greater a person is, the more knowledge a person has, the less important he realizes he is, because... He studies about so many things that are more important, more embracing than his little self. The ignorant person is always involved in their own little petty emotions. Their whole life revolves around the self. So therefore, they really can't get too far, and they always feel the self is extremely important. That's why the ignorant person always feels, hey, how could God do this to me? Because he feels he's the center of the universe, and Of course, God must be concerned with him. But the more intelligent person, like an Einstein or a great, realizes that man is really very unimportant in terms of the scheme of things. So he says the opposite thing, that God can't be involved with man. Man is too unimportant. As a matter of fact, King David expresses that in Psalms, where he says, what is man that you should remember him? Because King David was an intelligent individual, and he was a high-level person, and he recognized that human life really, if you look at it objectively, what is human life? We're relatively like nothing. But the speck, but nevertheless, King David says, as paradoxical as it is, we know the truth from the Torah that God is concerned about us. So we're fortunate in that sense. So Nachmanides explains, he says, that the purpose of miracles is to disprove all the above theories. Why? Because when God wrought miracles in the land of Egypt, and it was demonstrated that these miracles were done by God for the people of Israel at a specific time, when Moses predicted, and for the purpose of redeeming them, that's the concept of redemption, and everyone saw that, so then it dispelled all these doubts. It showed that God exists. It showed that God has knowledge of every detail, and it showed that God is concerned about man, and he relates to man, okay? That was the reason, the only reason, that God did the miracles in Egypt. He didn't do it to really get people emotionally involved with Torah because of miracles, because as you understand, just any person that has any sense knows that if that were the case, then it would be unfair to all succeeding generations who live at times when there are no miracles. So that would, God would be unfair. He gave these people, he gave them such great opportunity because he did miracles for them. But the other generations he didn't do. People live centuries and centuries. They don't see any miracles. Obviously, the answer is that the miracles do not help you in any way. Because even a person who sees miracles, the miracle does not improve the individual. No passive, no, nothing that happens to him. There's only one thing that improves the person. The person works on himself and perfects himself. And that's why you see throughout the Torah, even though they saw those miracles, you see that they lapsed. I mean, they were unable to... They backslid. The reason is because the only way for a person to advance truly is to work on himself, to improve himself, to change his inner structure, the inner structure of the psyche, to perfect himself, to guide, to this is something a person can only do himself with the benefit of Torah. Torah gives you the guide, but you have to work on yourself. And no miracle that a person experiences is ever going to improve him one iota. Doesn't do a thing. Okay? As a matter of fact, you see, as soon as they saw the miracle, a few days later, already they were backsliding. Why? Because the miracle is a momentary effect. But we often think, well, if I saw a miracle, it wouldn't mean a thing, because as long as a person is not perfected, he's never going to be free of envy, jealousy, hatred. All his desires and his energies are not going to be changed by that. The energy is going to still be going into those same areas. The only way you're going to redirect your energies into a higher sphere is through working on yourself and studying Torah and gaining more knowledge. It's the only thing that's going to prove you. So Nachmanides explains, that is why, that was the purpose of the miracles. Miracles really weren't done in order to impress people or in order to prove them. That's not the way to improve man through miracles. The Torah never really uses miracles to improve people. It always shows people just on the contrary. In spite of all the miracles, the people are still the same. They still haven't been improved, which is clearly what the Torah is trying to show us is exactly the opposite, that miracles, rather than improving people, doesn't do anything for them. But what does it do? This is what Nachmanides explains. If it doesn't do anything, so why did God do them? The answer is because miracles demonstrate a truth about God. Now, certain things, certain areas, you see, man can discover God on his own. This we know from great thinkers that came to the conclusion that God exists. We know it from our father Abraham, who was also a great thinker and also came to the same exact conclusion. But a person can never prove that God, this God, who is the creator of the universe. Yes, there must be a being that's different from the creation, that's behind all this wisdom and knowledge, that is not like the creation. That is the creator. That, an intelligent person can come to that conclusion, just like Albert Einstein did, and many others. But they will never be able to come to the conclusion that this source of existence relates to man. That's something. How are you going to prove that? How are you going to come to that conclusion? Very difficult to do. So this kind of knowledge is not something you can glean like King David says, the heavens declare the glory of God. That's true from studying the heavens, studying astronomy, studying the universe, you can see God. That's true. But can you see from the universe that God relates to man? On the contrary, you're going to say man is a speck. He's nothing. And the more knowledge you have, the more insignificant a person's individual personal life and preoccupations seem. To a small person, preoccupations seem very important. This happened to me today. That happened. When you study big things, all these things seem silly. And you realize that's really the benefit of Torah. Torah takes man into a higher world where he's involved in important things. And what the Torah is trying to do is to get a person to see that these little silly things in their life that they think are so important that aggravate them or even to make them happy, these things are unimportant. They're nonsensical. So the greater individual, you see, moves away from that kind of self-importance into the sphere of wisdom and knowledge. Move into that sphere, you can come to the conclusion, hey, there's so much knowledge in the universe. What am I? A little speck of nothing. So God had to show man that this is not true. As much as logically that's what we should conclude, but we can't draw logical conclusions because God is the only one that has the true conclusion. We may be able to understand the thing logically, and we're obligated to follow our mind, but that's only when something is absolutely logical. If something is 100% logical, the Torah says, that's it. But when you're drawing conclusions, that's a different kind of logic. In other words, if something's logical, it means two different things. If A equals B and B equals C, then A equals C, that's pure logic. But when you draw conclusions like, oh, it doesn't seem to me like God has to do with the man, that's not, that's logical in a different sense. It makes sense. We should really say it makes sense. But something that makes sense to man is not necessarily true. That we don't have. That power we don't have. We have good intuition, but our intuition is also flawed. We make mistakes when we follow our intuition. Sometimes we're right. Sometimes the intellectual intuition, by the way, is the basis of a whole Talmud. Because the whole Talmud, the right for Talmudic scholars to debate is because they have a right to operate on their intuition. But that's in the sphere of halacha. That's in the sphere of science and the sphere of mathematics, and there we have a right to operate on our intuition. But when it comes to conclusions about God, how God relates to the universe, there we're treading very thinly if we think that we can draw such conclusions. There we can't really draw conclusions. So a person will conclude based upon what's comfortable. He has no choice. But God wrought miracles in Egypt in order to teach man that that's not true. That God really does relate to man. Now, Nachmanides says very beautifully, he says, now once you know that, he says, then you know that God relates to man not just through the miraculous, but on a constant basis. That if a person is worthy, and a person is living, and the higher type of existence an individual lives, the closer he is to God, which means he's more under his divine providence. Same thing, but we just celebrated Purim not too long ago, and we read the book of Esther, and the Talmud states that we have a funny calendar. It's lunar months, but it's basically a solar system because you always have to have the month of Nisan this month, the month of Passover. The Bible says it is the month of spring, so it always must be in the spring. Now, if you just have 12 months, you're going to have a problem. Pretty soon it's going to be in the winter, and then the fall is going to keep moving up. So, therefore, every 3 years, we intersperse another month. Now, you understand, halacha is a very precise science, and you don't just do things simply, because since it's a very delicate science. So when you have something structured and you start putting something in there, it's not so simple. There are a lot of halacha ramifications. And there is a great difficulty with that 13th month that comes up, because that 13th month, ordinarily is the 12th, we call it Adar, and we have an Adar 1 and an Adar 2. There's a whole question about what the concept of that second month is, and it's a difficult halachic concept, but I'm not going to go into that right now. But the point is that we say, why do we celebrate the Megillah in the second Adar? Why don't we do it in the first? Usually when you have a mitzvah, you try to do it as soon as possible. Over here, you're postponing it to the second month. But because when they first formulated it, they wanted that the redemptions should be closer together, as close as possible. the redemption from Purim, that God redeemed the people and saved them from Haman, and the redemption from Egypt. Why are these two redemptions, what is the relationship between the two? Actually, the way Nachmanides explains it, it's a perfect harmony between the two. Because the miraculous events in Egypt that were really breaches in the laws of nature, that type of miracle God only did once, because he wanted to demonstrate once for all. By the way, that's why this commandment of discussion about the miracles in Egypt is the one commandment that the Torah tells us you must tell to your son. Why? Because Nachmanides explains. He says, God is not going to perform miracles in every generation before the eyes of every evil person or every apostate or every atheist. He's not going to do that. So therefore, the commandment is over here. It's very important. You should tell your son, because it should be given over from one generation to another, so that this truth is learned through the system of transmission, and God is not through repetition of miracles, because God's not going to do that. So therefore, this commandment, which teaches us about miracles, teaches us a very important thing. There are two kinds of, you see, the redemption. What does redemption mean? Redemption is not an act on the part of God, just some sensational act. Hey, God just took these people out. Let's get excited about this. That's not what it is. Redemption is there to teach you a concept. God relates to man. That is the concept. Now, that was demonstrated through breaches in the laws of nature in Egypt, but now we don't have that anymore. God's not going to do that again. But God is constantly relating to man, not through breaches in the law of nature, but through what Nachmanides calls and what the scholars call, and that's the Book of Esther. So if you read the Book of Esther carefully, I believe we went through part of it, you'll see there isn't a single miracle in that book. And yet that book is the one that the scholars of the Talmud say will remain in the eventually, at the end of days, in other words, when the ultimate redemption...
Rabbi, you got about 1 minute.
Okay. During the time of the ultimate redemption, that book and the five books of Moses will remain, and the reason is because harmony between those two. Because the five books of Moses was where God made breaches in the laws of nature to demonstrate certain truths. But the Book of Esther is an ongoing process. It means God is constantly relating to man through a hidden way, not through breaches in the law of nature. And that Book of Esther describes precisely, gives you insight into how that works. So the concept, the main concept that a person should derive from the whole night of the Seder, this is the essence of the whole thing, is that God relates to man. That's why Nachmanides says, it mentions many times in the Bible, this mitzvah is commemoration of going out of Egypt. Commemoration of going out of Egypt again and again and again. Why? Because the going out of Egypt